Oscar Podcast. Oscar Podcast. I'm here with Craig Kennedy from livinginCinema.com and Ryan Adams and me, Sasha Stone from awardsdaily.com. Today we have, we're going to be talking about, first about the Best Picture race, because that's what we do every week. And we're going to then specifically talk about Lincoln and Silver Linings Playbook. We're also going to talk about perceptions about the Oscar race and how you can change those perceptions and what changes them and why they are so important to what ends up winning Best Picture, and kind of the way that people sort of get on teams about movies, and they champion movies, and they try to kind of put down or denigrate other films in hopes that their film will win. And it really never works, and we'll talk a little bit about why. But first, let's talk about Best Picture. I think that right now it's looking like Lincoln is going to give Argo a lot of heat in the Best Picture race. I'm starting to feel like Lincoln is probably going to win. Its chances will only be diminished if Les Mis is better or Zero Dark Thirty is better. Argo is still very much in the game, but Lincoln has done so well with critics and at the box office that, and it's coming at such an important time, as we all thought it would, that its impact is significant, I think. What do you guys think?
That's the thing about it, is that it just seems much more consequential than Argo. I mean, I remember when Argo first came out, I was like, yeah, here's your Best Picture winner. But that was all of 3 weeks ago or however long it was, and I'm on to the new thing. But it definitely feels like Lincoln has gravity to it that Argo doesn't quite have. It's a movie that you feel like is going to be important 10 or 20 years from now.
I think I didn't know until yesterday, until I saw it a week ago, when only the critics had seen it and it only shown in limited release, and the only people who'd seen it were critics and bloggers. I wasn't sure how it was going to be received by audiences, but we see now after this weekend the really good box office, and in the theater where I saw it in a small town was packed, and the audience was like reverent. The audience was enthralled and by it and applauded at the end, and people were crying at the end.
Wow.
So that, you know, that's a good sign.
Yeah, because you bring with it a couple of very, very important things that critics of the film seem to be missing, which is love of Lincoln himself, the president, which, you know, an assassinated president is always going to be more beloved, and to mention the fact that he's probably the best and most important president in our history, that he ended the Civil War and he freed the slaves and he saved the Union and then he was shot in the head. I mean, if you're an American, you're going to identify strongly with that. You're going to feel a lot about that. And then also Steven Spielberg, who's been making films for almost 30 years, has finally turned in a really, really good movie after false starts over the years. And the combination of those two things and seems to me unbeatable. And then you also have Daniel Day-Lewis. For international audiences, you have Daniel Day-Lewis, who's a beloved actor globally. And then you have, it might be slightly boring for some people who aren't interested in American history, but they'll still be down with the performances and the crafts.
It's only boring for people who aren't seeing what's right in front of their faces. You know, a process can be interesting. And in this case, the process is our American government going about its weird, often messy, often unpleasant business to make something great happen. And I don't know how anybody who is an American and is not clear-eyed about all the flaws of our system can look at this movie and not feel a little bit proud. The movie kind of says, yeah, you know what? We're messed up. The system that we have is not perfect. There's false starts. There's dead ends. But at the end of the day, when history aligns itself properly, the right thing happens. And here's an example of that. And here's hoping that it can happen again.
And I can't imagine anybody. That's really good. That's excellent points. And I really think that also the reaction from the audience last night that I felt, people who are motivated to go see this movie in the first place are not the type of people who are going to be bored by it. You go into this movie knowing what to expect. You ought to know what to expect. You shouldn't think that it's going to be a vampire killer movie. It's not that. It's not that Lincoln. It's the Lincoln. It's historical, and people who are interested to see about, to learn about him, are not going to be bored by it. I can't imagine people, these anecdotal stories about people walking out. I don't even believe them.
Well, some people may look at Spielberg's name on it and just sort of assume that there's going to be sort of a sweeping, epic something feel to it. But if you really stop and think about the material that it's about, then you realize suddenly there's no room for that. You know,
it's pretty epic.
He could have made a Civil War movie, but this is not that movie.
Yeah, it's pretty epic. It's an intimate epic, but it's still pretty epic, I think. Yeah.
I mean epic in terms of, like, big battle scenes, mm-hmm, and widescreen, right, sunsets, mm-hmm, and, you know, yeah, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it's taken – how do you know you have a front runner? It's because people start attacking it. Well, so it's taken a couple of hits. One is Jeff Wells of Hollywood Elsewhere is bound and determined to take it down, quote-unquote, because – he really hates Spielberg and always has. And his first major takedown was for Munich back in...
his first perceived takedown. He thinks he had something to do with that, which is a load of nonsense.
And it didn't even take it down because the movie was still nominated for Best Picture, so yeah, with five nominees. So it's not really a quote-unquote takedown. I don't know what it is that he's hoping to accomplish here, but he's only going to make things better for Lincoln the more he keeps bragging on it, except for the kind of people that read him and follow him, which are a very specific demographic.
And, you know, I have to say, I did go look. I have been avoiding Jeff's site, but I did go look at Jeff's site, and nobody, even his own readers, are not buying his arguments. People are ridiculing him on his own site for some of the, for, like, quoting Armand White's, you know, review.
Yeah. Well, then I was going to say that's the other hit that Lincoln is taking, which infuriates me because they're saying that the characters, that the black characters were too passive and that why wasn't there Frederick Douglass in the movie? And the thing about it is, to me, it's like there are a lot of directors in Hollywood you can lay the racism thing at their feet. There's a lot of them that only cast white people. Look at Peter Jackson, Lord of the Rings, and The Hobbit. It's all white people. You can't lay that shit at Steven Spielberg's feet. He's one of the few major Hollywood directors who has made a conscious effort throughout his career to use a diverse cast. Look at The Color Purple, Amistad, even Jurassic Park, you know, and then now Lincoln. Like, this is a man who cares deeply about the civil rights cause and African Americans in Hollywood and in society. And I just think it's really, really unfair that people would take this opportunity to do that when in fact, there are three really pivotal African-American characters in the movie. One is, what's her name?
Gloria Rubens.
Gloria Rubin, you know, has that great scene with him outside the White House, which is probably the most pivotal scene in the whole movie, I think, because it talks about the future. It talks
I'm sorry, that scene to me is on par with Viola Davis in Doubt. I mean, that's one of the pivotal scenes where you only have one scene, but it can win you the Best Supporting Actress nomination for one scene.
Oh, I would love to see that. God, I didn't even think of that. Mm. But, you know, she's in the shadow of Sally Field, who arguably gives one of the best performances of the year as Mary Lincoln. But Gloria Rubin also addresses the thing that Lincoln is always called to the floor about, which is that, you know, he wasn't the abolitionist in the group. The team of rivals included Seward and Thaddeus Stevens, who were the real abolitionists, and Bates, Lincoln wasn't really. You know, it took mm-hmm. him through his presidency to really become strongly anti-slavery. And that scene really addresses it because he says, I don't know you, but I have a feeling I'm going to get used to you. Like, it's really honest, that moment. Mm-hmm. They don't paint him to be this abolitionist that we all would like to believe that he was, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that people who are making those claims are doing so unfairly without really looking at the movie and what's
amazing about Gloria Ruben's performance is that even in scenes where she has no lines, she's powerful just by her presence, her presence in the balcony at the House of Representatives, by her presence hovering around in the background and walking in and out of rooms, and the looks that she has on her face, reacting to things that other people are saying, is a powerful presence. And that's not at all passive.
Right.
No, she stands in for a whole group of people.
And she's the conscience. She's the conscience of the black community in the movie.
Yeah, because
while we're criticizing Spielberg for not making a black enough movie, let's remember how much crap he took from a lot of people, both The Color Purple and Amistad. A person who is, he's a white man, and he made an earnest attempt to make movies that were focused on black people, and he's damned if he does and he's damned if he doesn't, basically.
Right. Absolutely. They said, don't make a movie about the black community. Don't make a movie about the white community and the black community. You're just not allowed. Well, screw that. You know, I think it's just wrongheaded. We're allowed to tell this story about the 13th Amendment in America. This is all of our mm-hmm. history. It's a really important story to tell. It's really important for all American citizens to watch it, whether they're black or white or Asian or Hispanic. They should watch this fucking movie because mm-hmm. it's about the fact that we, the people, control our government and we, the people, decide. And it's about how easily oppression sets in. It really echoes today. The way the racists, you know, are coming out against Obama is very similar to back in the 1860s. It's all bubbling to the surface because racism is alive and well in America. And, you know, I hats off to Spielberg for trying to tell the truth as far as the Team of Rivals book dictates. You know, this is a story about the 13th Amendment. It's not a story about Frederick Douglass.
And, you know, that's the thing. You know, people who read, readers of Team of Rivals and critics, book critics, never said about Doris Kearns Goodwin that she should have had more black people in her book. People don't think they can rewrite a book. People don't go into a museum and think that there should be more black people in that painting. You don't, but everybody, like they say, everybody in Hollywood wants to be a director.
It's interesting because, you know, the book Team of Rivals tells a lot of interesting stuff about slavery that he could have put in if he was telling the whole story of Team of Rivals, but he's really focusing it very specifically on the 13th Amendment and what happened at that time. That's what the movie's about. Mm-hmm. In the book, you know, we learn about slaves who were fathered by slave owners who tried to get their freedom. We learn about how certain women controlled the men in their lives because they went and they saw slavery and it horrified them so much that they convinced their husbands to be abolitionists. You know, it's a lot of it's in the book, but it's impossible to put all that in the movie. You know, impossible. I think he, for given what the limited scope that he was focused, that they were focusing on, Tony Kushner, the writer, and Steven Spielberg, the director, they told the story, I think, as honestly and fairly as they needed to. I don't think that it's a movie about slavery. It's a movie about the end of slavery. It's a movie about moving forward, you know, mm-hmm.
It squeezes in a lot of stuff that's kind of on the periphery that is hinted at that is any smart person can look at and sort of expand upon in their own heads. It doesn't have to encompass the entire history of the United States within a 2-hour movie. You know, it's specifically about one event and a short span of a long presidency. It can't be everything all at once, but it's big enough and smart enough to at least allude to those things.
Absolutely. And Tony Kushner was giving the audience the benefit of the doubt that they were smart enough to glean from one line deeper meaning, like when Gloria Ruben says, my son was wearing Union blue when he died. You know?
Right.
That's my role in this country is as his mother.
As his mother, as in I'm a citizen. And she stands up for herself in that scene, which I can tell you what, people, weird people criticizing Steven Spielberg, that is something that would not have happened. So give me a break. They did design a scene specifically to represent a group of people that, you know, that there are people are saying that are not represented in the movie. That's just, they're just being blind about that, I think.
Can we put an end to bloggers and film reviewers and all of these people who've never shot a single frame of footage in their lives telling Steven Spielberg how he should end his movie? Yeah. Can we just stop that? I'm so sick of it.
I am too.
That's what I was trying to drive at earlier when I was trying to say that everybody in Hollywood thinks they're a director. And I think that everyone who sees a movie thinks they can direct the movie better than Spielberg and edit it better than Michael Caine. And then as if they didn't consider different places where they could have ended the movie.
Right.
But they chose this ending for a reason. And I'm not going to say that, that they're wrong. This is the piece of art that they gave us, and we judge it for what it is. We don't try to judge the movie that we wish we had.
Yeah, I don't understand that. I'm baffled by that. Like, when I see a thing like that and I think, you know, oh, that would have been a better place to end it, then it sends me down the road of thinking, well, why did they choose to end it that way? Well, here's why. It was his second inaugural address. It was a really important piece of philosophy by Lincoln. And it was the thing to send you out of the theater with. They had to include the death. They weren't going to close on him dying in his bed. That's too cliche. So he chose to he could have cut out the death and the speech, or have the death and then the speech, you know.
And, you know, time and time again throughout the movie, maybe a dozen different times, a dozen different scenes, people spoke about family members or people who they were close to who had died for the cause. At the end of the movie, we got to see that Lincoln died for the cause,
Absolutely.
Too. Absolutely. And to see his face, to see his lifeless face at the end of the movie was an echo and reflection of the faces of the dead soldiers that we'd seen on the battlefield.
Oh, absolutely.
Three or four or five times throughout the movie.
Yeah. 23,000 people died in the Antietam, that in one day. And it haunted and destroyed Lincoln that this is what was going on there, you know. And you're right. That's why his death had to be part of the story. It's so important, and it's so much a part of our memory of him as bleeding from the head, laying there with all of his people around him and poor Mary Lincoln crying. I mean, it's just so – it's been burned in our collective memory. You don't tell Lincoln's story and leave that out, I don't think.
And to end it with seeing him walk away and to leave it open-ended like that – when we all know the ending, this way Spielberg had a chance to actually show the flickering candle and Lincoln coming back through the flames of the flickering candle, that flame lives on. And his words of the second inaugural will always live forever, in spite of the fact that
the story doesn't end with his death.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's key. I mean, the second inaugural was key to... He wanted that in there. Spielberg wanted that in there. But more than that, he wanted to show that Lincoln... has so many lessons for us today that has to be telegraphed to us today. It's not just a movie. It's a movie, sure, but Lincoln's memory and the point of bringing it up at all is to remind us, you know.
The movie is a memorial to him. And the very first scene, it struck me the very first scene when first after the muddy battle, the close-up of the fist fights and the stranglings and the stomping people into the mud under their boots, under each other's boots, then you see Lincoln on a simple raised wooden platform with a lantern light only lighting his face and people gathered around him. It's almost like the scaffolding for the Lincoln Memorial right there. And then you realize that Spielberg is about to build a memorial to Lincoln. And the people who gather around him already have the Gettysburg Address memorized. Hmm. Even a few months after he's given it, it's already become legendary.
Yeah.
People already have committed it to memory. And the first scene of the movie is one of Lincoln's most famous speeches, and the last scene of the movie is one of his most famous speeches. And that is what he's left for us, and that's the memorial of the movie.
That's really a beautiful way to put it, Ryan, honestly. That's really great to hear it described that way. I totally agree with you. Boy, that thing is just a killer, that opening scene, isn't it?
It's amazing, yeah. And it's so simple, and it looks really straightforward, but it's so symbolic.
Yeah.
There's so much symbolism going on there.
Absolutely. That it just gave me chills. That's another scene, you know, the woman who was criticizing Spielberg for his quote-unquote passive black characters pointed out that scene as being, you know, really important, but then she said, oh, and then unfortunately it's all downhill from there. I think that's her own prejudice talking, but there is no denying the power of that opening scene. What he says, what he says to Lincoln, what we learn from that, you know? Beautiful movie. Really, really, maybe easily one of Spielberg's best films.
Can I amend something that I sort of said earlier?
Yeah.
A little bit? when I was criticizing people for criticizing Spielberg, I don't want to give the impression that you should never question art. In fact, I've been reading Robin Wood's Hitchcock's Films Revisited, mm-hmm. and in one of the 12 introductions to this current version of it, he points out that we shouldn't be afraid to take issue with works of art. They're not always perfect. You're always going to find flaws in them, but that's what makes them works of art. And if you're just going to put something under glass and hold it up as genius, then there's really not a lot of value to it. And I'm not suggesting that we do that with Spielberg, but I do feel in the moment when the movie is a week or two old, at a certain point, you have to look at the artist's career, and at some point, they've earned the benefit of a doubt. You can have issues, but I think you need to, or you ought to, approach it from a different angle and say, okay, well, why did they make the choices that they made, and try and come up with a reason for it. If down the road, you know, 5-10 years from now, those flaws still stick out, that's fine, but the movie just came out, so let's try and figure out what it is the filmmakers are trying to do before we dismiss them for doing it incorrectly.
I agree, although I will point out that my sister, who's not a film critic at all, and hardly sees any movies and never talks about movies and doesn't read any reviews, said the same thing about the ending of Lincoln. Like, that's how she felt. So I suspect that it isn't something that can be easily dismissed as in they're wrong. I just think it's something that can be discussed and interpreted. I remember people said the same thing about No Country for Old Men's ending. But after it won Best Picture and after people started seeing it and after it marinated in history, people never mentioned the ending, ever. So I think that there's a little bit of nitpicking going on, and I think that as time wears on, nobody will mention it at all. In fact, they'll talk. I mean, you know, they said the same thing about Schindler's List, by the way.
Well, about all of Spielberg's movies, people have a problem with the endings of almost all of his movies, and that's just the way he likes to end movies, and that's the way he does it. And you either buy into that, and you either accept it, and you try to understand, as Craig said, and as you said too earlier, Sasha, you try to understand instead of questioning their decision, you question it in terms of why did they make that decision?
Right, and it's our job. If you are a responsible film critic, it's really your job to look at it and discuss it with people like my sister, who aren't film critics but who were bothered by it. Like, she thought it should have had a bigger ending, a more emotional ending. Than she probably wouldn't have liked it if it had just ended on that one shot like everybody else seems to want. I think that that would have left the movie wanting. I think people still would have complained if he had ended it that way, because it's such a big life, it's such a big story. How do you end the story of Abraham Lincoln? You know, it's not easy, but Spielberg chose to do it with his own words. His own words and something to remember him by, which I think was really smart.
And he has to stick to the truth. It's not like he can send Lincoln up to the top of Devil's Tower and have a spaceship come down and haul him off into outer space. It has to be real. So what do you do? How do you end a movie about something that really happened differently than how he did?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could do what he did in Schindler's List. You could bring it up to the modern world. You could show a black professor talking, you know, saying one of his speeches in front of a classroom. But I think that's even corny. Like, I don't know. I mean, I think you make a choice and you go with it, and people either like it or they don't. I don't think that anybody would be dumb enough, although maybe some people are, to judge the whole movie based on what they consider to be one wrong decision.
That was literally the first. I tried to avoid all. Once it started screening, I tried to avoid all information about it. I didn't want to know what anybody thought. But of course, if you're on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, it's inevitable. And literally the first thing that I heard about Lincoln was, Spielberg still doesn't know how to end a movie. And I just wanted to reach through my computer screen and strangle that person to death.
I was pretty mad at my sister for saying that too the second time I saw it, because it's legitimate. It's a legitimate complaint, like you said, Craig.
And it opens conversation, and that's important. Why I kind of backtracked a little bit. I don't want to stamp out disagreement at all.
Right. No.
And I'll admit it right here that I'm a little defensive about it because of people like Jeff Wells, who have made it part of their aesthetic mission in life to eliminate this film from the conversation. I'm pushing back, but I really shouldn't be. I want there to be debate and conversation. That's what makes the movie alive.
Yeah. The thing that really annoys me even more than the ending talk is people saying it's boring. Nothing bothers me more than that. I mean, I understand to some people it is probably boring. It was probably boring to my 14-year-old daughter, you know. And it just bothers me that there are adult people that think that. You know,
those people are boring.
That's what I was saying. I think if you're going, I think the people who are most going to be most attracted to see this movie in the first place, most motivated to buy a ticket, are not going to be the people who are going to be bored by it, unless you just go in, unless you're just totally clueless about what it's going to be, unless you think it's going to be started off with Lincoln's birth and follow him throughout his entire life and all of his adventures or something. You know, yeah. It's not that.
So, okay, well, that's great. We you know, you're not going to hear us criticizing or complaining about Lincoln on this podcast. So, you know, we love the movie, and all that's left to be decided is whether or not it will win Best Picture. So I wanted to talk a little bit about perception and how that can play into it somehow. As you can feel right now, unless you're Jeff Wells and his readers, the build-up, the buzz, this is called Oscar buzz. What you're hearing about Lincoln right now is Oscar buzz. It's Silver Linings Playbook has it too, I have to admit. It's got a lot of heat around it, people really loving it. They're, you know, applauding and clapping and skipping out of the theater happy, and you know, it's people really like Silver Linings Playbook. They do. They like it. So those two movies have absolute Oscar heat. And where perception comes in is Oscar voters like to vote for the underdog. So they, if your movie's in first place and it's viewed as an underdog, as some of them sometimes are, like The Artist, Slumdog Millionaire, both of those movies were front runners early on, remained front runners, never lost. And every time they won, it felt like the underdog was winning, because it was an unlikely winner, silent movie. And then with Slumdog, it was kind of like a movie about impoverished Indian kids, right? So a movie like Lincoln or Argo is going to have a harder time, because the perceptions of those heading into the race is that they're already going to be quote-unquote Oscar movies. It's the same with Les Mis and Zero Dark Thirty. So, but both Argo and Lincoln are incredible movies. They're not like B movies. They're A movies. They're doing really well, both of them. So all that's going to be necessary for the studios is to maintain underdog perception for these films. And that's not going to be easy, especially for Lincoln, which, look, I mean, think of people winning the DGA award. Think of who's going to garner the most goodwill winning the DGA. Well, in my mind, Spielberg does. There's nobody else who's going to win that award that's going to look better than Spielberg winning it.
And like Ryan said last week, it's coming from both TV people and cinema people, and Spielberg appeals to both of those, having been both of those.
And, you know, he's been off the awards radar for a really long time. So he's totally finally making good again on his early promise. And that's irresistible. They're not going to want to give it to Tom Hooper again, I can tell you that. And David O. Russell, maybe. You know, I could see that happening. And Ben Affleck, possibly. I just see that Spielberg is going to be like, you know, one of these heavy hitters entering the race. It's not like Hugo. It's Hugo cost a lot of money and didn't make enough money. If it had made double its production costs, Scorsese probably would have won. But Lincoln's making a lot of money, and it's getting the best reviews of Spielberg's career since Schindler's List. So,
when you were talking about perception earlier, and this is just a theory of mine, and feel free to tell me that I'm full of it, but I think perception is a lot of what's fueling Silver Linings Playbook. It was a movie that came into Toronto that I don't think anybody really expected a lot out of. Or am I wrong about that? And the fact that it got the audience award and made people happy kind of put it into the conversation, and it kind of has this built-in underdog status simply because it was sort of underestimated to begin with.
Yep, and deliberately so. They wanted to, as David O. Russell said in an interview, the Weinstein Co. Is hoping that it would stay, like, they didn't want it to win that award necessarily. They were hoping it would stay the underdog because they think they can win that way, and they might. They just might. The Oscar voters vote with their heart, and when you have all these other, especially when you have a split vote year, this is very much like 1976. If you think Argo and Lincoln are like Network and All the President's Men, and you have Rocky, which is Silver Linings. So, you know, a lot of women will vote for it. People who are totally into it and don't like Lincoln's boring to them, or Argo's boring, and just want to vote for something that makes them feel something, and, you know, they get to fuck the pretty blonde girl. Silver Linings, you know.
It is a lot like Rocky, because Rocky was a sports oriented movie that had a corny soap opera romance aspect to it too. It has a dick lit with a dash of chick lit thrown in.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yep. And it's a fantasy. It's a rescue fantasy on both sides. So it is rocky. Mm-hmm. It's formulaic. It's fine. You know, I mean, it's not David O. Russell's best movie. That would still be flirting with disaster. But it's fine. Jennifer Lawrence makes it a lot better than it is, and Robert De Niro's pretty good in it. I like the first half of it a lot better than the second half. Like, I think the first half, it's the movie that I was hoping it would be, you know, really.
Right up to the tailgate party where they're at the Eagles game. Yeah. That's where it starts to go south, and then it never recovers.
It goes south there, and then it loses me on her character when she starts spouting baseball stats. Because to me, that's when she morphs into a blow-up doll.
You know, she never did that in the book, though. That's something they added to the movie that wasn't in the book. She never gets into football in the book at all. And I kept expecting that was going to happen, but she never goes that way. So that's something they actually added to the movie that sounds like it made it worse.
Well, I have to preface this with, we have to admit, you know, that this is me. Sasha Stone is the only person complaining about this. I mean,
that particular scene.
Yeah. Chris Tapley has said that he agrees with me, and Craig probably, I don't know if you agree with me or not, Craig, but most people, women and Thompson, you know, all my female friends love this movie. They have no problem with it at all. No problem with the female character, nothing. So this is just me. So to that end, I don't know if it can then be applied to, obviously, the critics. It's got great reviews. I didn't think it would. So, you know, good for Jeff. Jeff Wells is probably really happy that it's doing so well since he, you know, it's his movie of the year. And he's picking his team, and he's calling me living in the Lincoln bubble. And that
he's all alone, though. I really think I'm not saying he's all alone in liking this movie, but I believe he's all alone on his site as far as bashing Lincoln and trying to elevate Silver Linings Playbook to a masterpiece. Even his own readers are not agreeing with him on that. I refuse to think that he's got a team of people behind him who are all, like, you know, on Jeff's team. I just don't see that. I'm not really bashing the movie. I haven't even seen it yet, but I know from the book that the book started out in the same way that you guys say that the movie did. I thought I was going to really like the book. The first few chapters, I thought, this is really interesting. But it just got worse and worse and worse. And the end of it, the ending of it, the last third was terrible.
What happens in the book?
In the movie, there's all the stuff about the letters, right? The letter that she acts as intermediary between his...
Horrible.
That just got so transparent and tedious to me. I could see through I could see what was happening right away.
Same here.
And it just, so what it is, I mean, for me... you know what? We're talking about zeitgeist. Lincoln is such a zeitgeist movie for the Obama's reelection. For me, if Romney had been reelected, Silver Linings Playbook would be perfect. Because what it is, you've got someone lying to you in order to make them fall in love with you.
Right.
Right.
And then you have to take Zoloft in order to deal with it.
Right. And she doesn't even need that in the movie because she's a fucking hot. She's the hottest woman in Hollywood right now. That's the funniest part. It's like, love me, love me. It's like a Porsche driving next to you. Drive me, drive me.
Okay. No, really.
All right, if I have to. But
that's also but it doesn't exist in the book, though, because in the book she's older than him and he's never interested in her, never shows any kind of never seems to express any physical interest in her whatsoever in the book until the last 10 pages.
That's the same with the movie, but it's unbelievable because it's Jennifer Lawrence.
I mean, no, really.
What if it was like Melissa Leo? You know, I mean, that would be more believable to me.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, listen, look at the critic reviews, watch the box office. Know what they're doing over there, Team Weinstein. And I just have to say about Weinstein as a side note, that guy, man, it's so funny. I was watching, I don't know if you watched Deep or SEAL Team 6 about the Bin Laden raid. Mm-hmm. Well, remember right before the election when the stupid Republicans had that hideous Obama's America 2016? Thank God that thing was just... put out of its misery forever when Obama won. But they put up this movie, and the conservatives were all having a fit because they said that Weinstein re-edited it to put Obama in. And I was like saying, oh, come on, you guys. That's really what happened. I'm sure it's not biased towards Obama, and you're crazy. It's not propaganda. I finally watched it, and it's totally like an Obama infomercial.
Good. That's good. And, you know, and I don't have anything against Harvey. I think he's fantastic, and I have so much respect for so many, 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 many of the movies that he's been behind, and so many of the movies that he's pushed I've really, really liked. Just not all of them.
No, same here. And I'm not going to let myself get upset this year. If Silver Linings Playbook, the weakest film of all of them, wins, I can't get upset about it because I have to figure – That's the Academy. They live with their choices. That's what they say is the best picture. Okay, fine. So that's the best picture to them, you know. I'm just not going to get caught up in it again because it's not really worth it. If that's really the kind of quality that they're holding up as the highest achievement of the year, well, then they're completely messed up.
Right. We found out. Yeah, we discovered we cannot shame them into doing better than into raising their standards. We can't shame them. They're unashamed in their taste.
This won't be the first time that they've chosen a mediocre movie as best picture. It happens all the time. But let's talk some more about why it is a mediocre movie. Rather than trying to determine whether it's going to win the Oscar or not, let's talk a little bit more about whether it deserves to. And for me, the biggest problem with it is the Jennifer Lawrence character. They give a lot of time to Bradley Cooper in the movie and his character. It's his movie, and that's fine. And actually, I have to say Bradley Cooper is really wonderful in it. He's not an actor that I've ever really liked that much. But he's really, really good in this. But the Jennifer Lawrence character is just sort of calculated to be sort of therapeutic value for the Bradley Cooper character. She doesn't ever really seem like a real human being. If the movie had been about two damaged, horribly flawed people who get together and sort of fix each other's problems, which is sort of what it wants to be, it could have been a great movie. As it is, since they slight Lawrence and her problems and make her... She basically fixes herself just by deciding. They set her up as her problem being that she gives too much without expecting anything in return. So there's one scene where she decides she's going to expect something from Bradley Cooper, and that's going to fix him and it's going to fix her. But it's just way too easy. And by the time the movie rushes towards its romantic finale, it just feels empty because of that. And it's too bad because the material was there for a really, really, really good movie, the movie that people seem to think that it is and are talking about it as it is, but it's just not. As it is, it's a nice movie, it's a good movie, it's entertaining, but it's not, it stops well short of being anything that I would ever talk about as being something I'd want to give an award to.
Well, one thing I noticed about the critics' reviews, I was telling Ryan this, is that I really see the old critics' darling thing at play. And what they're talking about is embracing what they consider to be the David O. Russell style. And they're saying he's flying high with his David O. Russell style, as in he made the ultimate O. Russell movie here. And to me, that's like sloppy, piecing it all together, working things out much too easily, cartoon characters, funny and crazy, but not quite crazy enough, as in Flirting with Disaster, where everybody was just off the charts nuts. Think of how funny that movie was with the sun in the kitchen cooking the quail with the acid and Lily Tomlin and Alan Alda and Patricia Arquette, you know, worrying about her weight. I mean, these are real characters. And to me, it was so gritty and so funny and so real. But this didn't feel real to me at all. It felt like a male fantasy all the way down the line. Like, they can't make her sex positive. They can't make her someone who just enjoys fucking guys. She can't be that. So she has to be damaged. Damaged goods. I only slept with everybody in my office because my husband died and I was in pain, so come help me, you know.
That's a little bit of a spoiler. I don't know if we should...
No, it's out there.
It's not? Oh, okay, good. Okay.
It's way out there. Everybody knows that about the movie, but it's just because it's in that one scene, a couple of scenes in the trailer, for instance.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I know that the thing about how she fucks everybody is in there, but I didn't know if the reason for it, if her psychological damage was revealed until, because it wasn't in the book revealed until the very end.
Oh, really? Oh, in the movie, it's pretty early, and it's in
okay.
the trailer.
Okay, good.
I mean, unless
Never
it's
mind.
Not about her husband dying, unless it's about something else.
No, it is about that. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, no. That would be nice if they had revealed it at the end. But, you know, it's like these Oscar movies, they always have to have the whore with the heart of gold, you know, and it's always like it's Mercedes Rule in Fisher King, you know, and it's, they have to, in Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman, and, you know, the most fuckable they can make them. They do tend to do really well with the Academy. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. Like, it's fine if the character is ultimately well drawn out. But in this movie, she's a supporting character. She's not a lead because it doesn't go on her arc at all. It goes on his arc. And
she barely has one.
And every Oscar movie this year is about a central male figure, and the women are supporting that figure to reach his realization, to get better, to be better. And that silver lining's all the way down the line. I was disappointed that I could call every single shot that happened after the after the tailgate party, everything was predictable to me. The letter, mm-hmm. the dance, everything mm-hmm. was, I could call it. And so mm-hmm. it didn't work on me. I didn't go, oh, yay, they won. You know, it didn't happen for me. So that was one reason why I didn't like it, was because it, whatever thing it's doing to people, it didn't do to me, you know. But also
that's the way I feel about football and about Dancing with the Stars too, which is really what this movie is. It's football and Dancing with the Stars.
That's exactly right.
And those are the two audiences that it's going to appeal to.
That's right.
Exactly what it is. And it's all white people. Well, no, there's like one black character in it. And he's pretty funny. I mean, I agree with Craig that I loved Bradley Cooper and I love Jackie Weaver and all mm-hmm. the stuff with the family. All the whole first half of the movie, see, felt like a David O. Russell movie. But then it felt like it cashed a check and it became this like silly romantic comedy. They dropped all the stuff about mental illness. It basically didn't exist anymore. It was just about guy gets girl back, you know.
That's the thing, is that the people who like it seem to be treating it as though it's a romantic comedy that's somehow been elevated by the genius of David O. Russell. But I look at it as exactly the opposite, that it's taking the genius of David O. Russell and selling him out in a romantic comedy that's not worthy of his talents.
I agree. And I hope that if he – I think that he – if he wants to win the Oscar – he's now with the Weinstein Co., whereas he was with Paramount before with The Fighter. He probably got pretty close. It frustrated him. Now he's on what he considers he's with a guy who probably can win him an Oscar. If anybody can do it, the Weinstein Co. can. And as we always say, to win Oscars, you have to dumb it down. David Fincher would have to change significantly to win an Oscar because they're never going to vote for the kind of movies he makes. So you have to weigh that. Is it worth winning an Oscar to totally change your style and to suck up to those people and to in order to win and become more powerful in the industry so that you can then go make the kind of movies you really want to make? Or is it better to stick to your own style and have your integrity and make the kind of movies you really like to make? I'm not saying he's a sellout for this. I'm just saying, to me, it seemed clearly designed to win Oscars, more so.
That's the thing, is I wouldn't want to call him a sellout either, because this is a guy who for 5 years got nothing on the screen, and his career, in a lot of people's estimations, was probably over after I Heart Huckabees came out, which I actually really liked but didn't do great with critics and kind of bombed with audiences. And then there was that viral video of him raking Lily Tomlin over the coals that just made him look like a screwball wingnut jerk, plus the rumors of him getting in a fist fight with Clooney on Three Kings. This is a guy who was in career maintenance mode. He's lucky actually to be working. And I think I wouldn't want to criticize him for I wouldn't want to say that he's selling out.
You know, isn't it weird, though, since you brought that up, I wasn't going to, but it's been on my mind. Isn't it weird that David Fincher gets criticized and brutally, really, for being remote and distant and not playing the game? And then you have someone like David O. Russell with his personality problems. And there's no other way to describe it. His personality problem that everyone is well aware of, but he seems to skate free on that.
It's because he made a warm fuzzy like The Fighter, whereas Fincher hasn't and probably will never do something like that.
To a certain degree, we have to just step back and say the Oscars are a game, and the Weinsteins are really good at that game. And if David O. Russell wants to win an Oscar, and this is the way he's going to do it, more power to him. You know, I'm not going to get in that way. Fine, if that's how they want to play it. I'm saying it's not going to bother me that David O. Russell wins, because if he really wants to, he should. But it doesn't mean that the better film is winning, because Lincoln is a better film. Lincoln is a fucking insane, awesome achievement. But look, Steven Spielberg is Steven Spielberg, and David O. Russell is David O. Russell, you know? Nobody's going to begrudge Steven Spielberg losing anything. The guy practically owns Hollywood. He's already got Oscars, you know? Mm-hmm. David O. Russell's got squat, you know? So if he wins, good. You know, we'll cheer him on that he's got that big success in his life. But we will all know that it doesn't necessarily – it doesn't mean that the better film has won. It just means that they played the game better.
It means that David O. Russell and Paul Haggis both have Oscars. Great. Congratulations, guys.
Don't forget Tom Hooper.
So you guys can get together and have your Oscars kiss each other. Just like play little Oscar games with your little toys.
Tom Hooper can photograph them in Dutch angles.
It would totally mean more to David O. Russell than it would to Steven Spielberg, put it that way. But Steven
and all the power to him. And I don't know if we're back on the record or not yet, but I want to point out that I kind of criticized the Oscar echo chamber. Was it last week or the week before? I think maybe it was the week before. And how the perception of a film's Oscar-ness sort of dictated whether it was actually good or bad, and that sometimes we tend to push back or push for a movie Oscar-wise that we're excited about. I think I'm trying to avoid pushing back too hard against Silver Linings Playbook simply right. because of the Oscar buzz, but that's not really fair to the movie itself. Taken on its own, it's a fine movie. It's a good movie. It just isn't something that I think is a great movie, and I bristle at the idea that anybody would suggest that it is.
That's the way I feel about The Artist. I feel like I probably would have liked The Artist of it a lot more. And I can say this about a lot of movies. I would like a lot of movies a lot more if they had not won Best Picture. It's the fact that they won Best Picture that's when I started to hate them.
Because all it really means is they liked it more.
Yeah.
And that's the
right.
hard thing mm-hmm. to swallow if you really love people who take daring risks with filmmaking mm-hmm. like Spielberg has done with Lincoln. And not that it's such a huge daring risk. I mean, he's still Steven Spielberg. It's Lincoln. But that they all spent so many years working on it, the dedication involved, the level of difficulty, all that stuff adds up to me a deserving Best Picture winner. And I mm-hmm. think that it shouldn't – the Oscars have evolved into a dangerous trend, totally started around really with the King's Speech. It used to be that you couldn't win Best Picture unless you had a huge body of work behind you and you were reaching a career high. And then they would say, even if you didn't have a big body of work, like, for instance, Ben Affleck with Argo, the mm-hmm. old school Oscars would reward him for this because he's put in two other movies. He's turned in out a $100 million film that got really great reviews, and they should reward that success, or Spielberg. But in the days of Tom Hooper coming out of nowhere and Michelle Hazanavicius coming out of nowhere, and, well, David O. Russell's not coming out of nowhere. He's been kicking around Hollywood forever. So if Silver Linings is his crowning achievement and this is his big Oscar moment, I feel like we got to just step back and say, good for you. You know, great, you finally did it. But mm-hmm. we will all know that it came at the cost of the Oscars having another year where they rewarded a film that didn't really deserve to win over films that did.
And I will just say that there have been a few isolated instances in Oscar history where films have won without the pedigree behind them, where it has been someone coming out of nowhere, like with Marty or like even with Rocky. But those always, in retrospect, are the weakest of the Best Picture winners.
Yeah, or, I don't know, American Beauty was kind of like that. And that's sort of mm-hmm. up in the air as to whether how people, some people think it didn't deserve it, some people think it did. Mm-hmm. I happen to think that it was a really good film and a zeitgeisty film and deserved to win. Mm-hmm. But that's just my own opinion. I don't downgrade that at all. But that was more like a fluke, more like a fluke. But I feel guilty for rooting against David O. Russell only because he is scrappy and he is struggling and he really does want to win an Oscar. So, part of me feels guilty for panning the movie. And that's why I got so mad at Jeff when he outed my feelings about it. I didn't want to publicly come out against the film. You know, I was telling him my honest impressions in the garage that day after the screening. And I mm-hmm. said, this movie's not going to win Best Picture. Are you kidding? And he had a huge fit. He got on his scooter. He zoomed off. And then he tapped out these angry things. And I just said, Jeff, don't publish this. Oh, you're just going to hurt the movie. I don't want anybody to know in the Weinstein Co. or David O. Russell or anybody. I don't want my negative feelings out there. And he published them anyway. And, I don't want to bash the movie. I don't want to do that. I don't feel right about it. I still feel bad about bashing The King's Speech so hard. And War Horse even, It's like, mm-hmm. I can feel this way about the movie, but I don't have to campaign against it. I don't want to be Jeff that way, But,
Yeah, by responding to Jeff, you're becoming Jeff. Not you personally. I'm doing the same thing.
Right. And I don't want to do that. It's just a silly game we have to remember. I love Lincoln, and I love Argo and Life of Pi, and I'm sure Beasts of the Southern Wild and Zero Dark Thirty. I don't know about Les Mis. I mean, I just feel like it's an embarrassment of riches. Mm-hmm. Incredible movies this year. And if they decide to go for the weepy, softy, emotional one, well, good for David O. Russell. You know, he's finally reached that point in his career where he can say he's an Oscar winner. You know, it's about time, right? So what the hell?
If it happens, I hope he takes it and then goes and makes something weird again, like I Heart Huckabees.
Yeah, I do too. I hope he does. But like you said, people turned away from him, and now he needs that. I felt it with The Fighter. I felt that he really wanted to win for that.
Mm-hmm.
Because wasn't he the one who laughed when Tom Hooper won?
I don't remember.
I don't know.
DGA, you know, Tom Hooper beating him and David Fincher, and it's probably something I will never get over. I will never, till my dying day, I will still be mad about that. But that them's the breaks, you know. We have to learn after all these years that this is how it goes. I'm just stealing. I'm stealing myself up for it, is what I'm trying to tell you guys. Mm-hmm. I'm stealing myself up for Jeff's smug "I told you so." I'm stealing myself up for David O. Russell and everybody jumping up and cheering because Silver Linings won.
Well, you know, even if I had nothing to do, if I had no attachment or no dog in the race at all, no dog in the hunt, and if I wasn't trying to relate this to Oscars at all, I just don't like movies like Silver Linings Playbook, and I don't like movies like The Fighter, and I don't like movies like The Wrestler, and I don't like Rocky. They're movies that don't appeal to me. I would never see this movie until it came on HBO if it wasn't in the Oscar race. I would never have bothered to read this book if a movie hadn't been based on it. I don't read books like this, and I realize now after finishing it why I don't. I hated it. It was like such a struggle to get through the last 100 pages. I couldn't wait for it to be over.
Is the book about bipolar? Does he have bipolar in the book?
Book is a lot darker than it sounds like the movie is. The book has a little bit of a much darker ending than it sounds like the movie does. And I thought it was going to. I thought the character was going to have. You know, it's first person narrative. The guy telling his story is like written in almost like a journal, and so it's all. So it's all about him, and everybody else is just on the fringe of his life. And you realize that he's a very unreliable narrator. He's telling. He's delusional, and you think that might be interesting, and it is for the first 100 pages. But he's such a childlike, immature person that you get sick of him. I did anyway. I got sick of him halfway through the book, and I didn't even care if he ended up happy or not.
Well, my problem was I kind of agree with you there because I was watching it going, I really like Jennifer. I really like Jennifer Lawrence's character. I really like her. I want her mm-hmm. to do something better with her life than chase around after this asshole, you know?
Yeah. You know how I feel about the book, and it sounds like maybe the movie, too. It may have a happy ending, and then the credits come up, but I have the feeling that 10 pages after the book ends and an hour after the movie ends, he's going to be getting in another fight in a parking lot someplace. This guy's not cured. He's got real problems.
Well, that's That's right. The movie tries to make it out like it just happens, but 9 times out of 10, people on heavy meds like that go off their meds.
Yeah, this guy is fucked up, and he's always going to be messed up. And I don't think that just because the movie decides to end at a place in his life when he's happy, I don't think any of these people are going to be happy.
And did it strike anybody else that the worst possible two people you could put together are a narcissist who only takes and a person who is only capable of giving? That just seems like a recipe for disaster to me.
It did.
I know, and really sad for her.
It hurt me as a mom watching it because I was like, "No, Tiffany, that's not right. You're capable. You know, there's so much more to you than adapting yourself to this guy, football stats, and you know, dancing around." I mean, she was. It's part of it is Jennifer Lawrence is such a good actress that she elevates that character. If it wasn't played by her, if they wanted to go the piece of ass route and they just picked some dumb actress who couldn't pull it off, you wouldn't really think twice about it. You'd just be like, oh, yeah, whatever. If they picked somebody like Melissa Leo or, I don't know, Mia Wasikowska or somebody who isn't so drop-dead gorgeous, you'd consider her character a lot differently. But it being Jennifer Lawrence and her being so strong and being such a good actress, it just didn't follow that she would be interested in this guy. I didn't see what the appeal was. It's not like he's cute, but he's not Brad Pitt, you know? And he ignores her through the whole thing, and all she has to do is chase after him. It's like, aim a little higher, you know? That's really what you're going for in life? That's it? And I know that that's just my feminist mom in me, but that's how I felt. I felt like, really? Because even in As Good As It Gets, which is a good paradigm for this movie, you know, with Helen Hunt and Jack Nicholson, it's like, yes, he's all messed up, but she puts him in his fucking place. And she tells him, you know what, you're rich, you're offering me all this stuff, but I don't think so. And she goes back home, and then he has to really, work hard to win her over. Silver Linings, it's like, I snap my fingers and you come running like a little lap dog, you know. Mm-hmm. And that bothered me about it. He should have had to work a lot harder to win her over.
He changes, but his change is so quick that it's not believable.
Yeah, his change is I go on the meds and I notice you. My change is I notice you now. Oh, really? You do?
Right. We're expected to believe over the course of a week after he discovers the truth about the letter that he just he just totally flips, and he's suddenly all better now.
And what does she get out of it?
He's a kind, giving man now.
I know, and she gets, what does she get out of it? Nothing. She gets nothing out of it. She's better off at home. I mean, it's like, well, maybe she gets the Robert De Niro and those guys. She gets a family, and she gets to be part of this group. Maybe that's great.
But they're, what a messed up family. Wasn't the family, I hope the family was as messed up in the movie as they are in the book, because they're all mentally ill, too. The father
is
mentally ill.
Yeah, it was especially clear that the dad was screwed up in the movie.
Who plays the mother in the movie?
Jackie Weaver. She's great.
Oh, okay, yeah, great. Yeah, I can see that.
She's one of my
and actually, Robert De Niro's perfectly cast as the father, too. And I just heard from someone on Twitter yesterday that originally, I think when David O. Russell first became aware of the book, he had Mark Wahlberg in mind for the lead character. And that works for me, too, because he has that sort of slightly baffled attitude about things going on around him. You know, he doesn't quite grasp the reality of things around him. He can carry that off really well.
And he's a hot enough guy where you could see her wanting to just be around him because he's that hot. You know?
Yeah, and in the book, too, he's all about the muscles. He's all about working out and getting in top peak physical condition. And Mark Wahlberg is perfect for that, too.
Yeah, Wahlberg actually would have been better than Cooper. And, yeah. I'm saying that as somebody who liked Cooper in the movie a lot.
I liked
Wahlberg
him, too.
It's like a glove.
I liked him, but I didn't like him in terms of her being attracted to him. Like I would liked it just him being having a story of bipolar. For some reason, I kept comparing this movie silently in my mind to Ordinary People, which is so much better, obviously. But it really made me appreciate Ordinary People so much more because it really doesn't take the easy way out with people who are having problems. Like, for instance, the character in Ordinary People, who's his friend, and she says, let's have a great Christmas, you know, and then the very next thing that happens is she kills herself. I mean, serious shit, that they're dancing around in Silver Linings. It's really serious stuff. It's not just you take a pill and you're better, you know. It's I mean, I guess with some people it is, but if it's severe enough to really mess up your life like that, it's not you take a pill and you're better, A, and B, you got to watch out if you're Tiffany, because he was fucking stalking his wife where he needed a restraining order against her.
Right.
Who knows what he would have done? And she's just tripping right into that, you know, without thinking twice. So it was troublesome to me all the way through, but I guess I'm not the critics. I'm not other women. I don't live on Planet Female. I don't know what the deal is with that. But all the same, I wish David O. Russell had made a better movie. But if this is the movie that's going to win him the Oscar, more power to him, you know.
So sad for me. I mean, I can see. I agree. I'm not going to get emotionally involved like I have for the past 2 years because I just am in such a funk. March, April, and May and June. You know, afterwards, it just takes me so long to snap out of it when I get so disappointed. So I just am not going to allow myself to be so emotionally invested this year.
No way. Think
about it this way: when we wake up the morning after the Oscars, regardless of who wins the Oscar, President Obama is still going to be the guy.
That's right. Exactly.
And that's all that really matters.
That's right.
Going to be riding high on that forever. I mean, if it was up to me, Lincoln would sweep. It would win picture, actor, supporting actress, supporting actor. It's never going to happen. There's only
screenplay.
Two.
Screenplay for sure.
Oh, it's going to win screenplay. No question. And it would win cinematography.
Yeah.
It would win costumes. It would win art direction. Although, I don't know, The Master is still kicking around in my mind for art direction. Jack Fisk. And then his cinematography in that, too, is just incredible.
Even just the department store scenes in The Master were enough to win it an Art Direction Award.
See, that's the problem when you're Weinstein, you've got all these great movies. It's like, which one do you choose? So he's got Silver Linings now, so the Master is pretty much being thrown under the bus. And they're not really championing hard that movie because it was divisive and you can't really sell it to Oscar voters. And then, so that's going. And then here comes Django Unchained. It's like, what are they going to do if it's a huge hit, you know? Are they both going to be in competition against each other for Best Picture? I don't know. That's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
It's interesting that you mentioned that. That makes the buzz about Silver Linings all the more frustrating because it just takes attention away from a much, much better movie. And it's going to be Harvey Weinstein is a guy who knows where he's at, so he can test the waters and he can see which movie has the better chance, and he's going to throw his energies behind that movie. So if people are not talking about The Master and they're talking about Silver Linings, that's going to be the one that he pushes, and that's really too bad.
Well, because Paul Thomas Anderson would have to do what David O. Russell is doing. He'd have to make a sappy crowd pleaser to win. And we don't want him to do that, right? We want him to keep making the great movies that he's making. So the sacrifice for that is it doesn't win Oscars. Stanley Kubrick movies never won Oscars. Hitchcock's movies rarely won them. Scorsese rarely won until The Departed. I mean, you have to weigh that. You have to say the Oscar winners are about compromise. It's about a consensus vote. It has to be dumbed down to the lowest common denominator, except for those few years where it didn't, which are few and far between, where The Departed and No Country and The Hurt Locker won. And you go back to the 70s when the winners were really great. For the most part, a consensus vote means you have to appeal to the widest amount of different tastes. And a lot of people like Silver Linings Playbook, and not a lot of people like The Master.
A lot of people did, but a lot of people also really didn't like it. You know, it was just really polarizing, and Silver Linings Playbook does not seem to be that polarizing. A few of us are down at the very South Pole, but we're all alone with the Penguins.
Yeah, at the very least, you still kind of like the movie. It's a hard movie to really hate unless you really want to.
Right.
Yeah. I didn't hate it. I just was a little annoyed with it. I won't watch it again. It's not a movie I would see again, ever. Because I was so disgusted with the Jennifer Lawrence. I also didn't like how she was trotting around in Danskins, bouncing her boobs up and down and sticking her ass in the camera. I mean, I'm not a prude or anything, but it just seemed to add insult to injury to me.
I wouldn't mind that if it doesn't sound like it's any more than a cock tease, though, because like you said, it doesn't really come to fruition. There's no sex. There's no consummation of that in the movie, at least. And they never actually, you know, get it on.
Well, the guys like it. People like Jeff Wells and all the critics.
Yeah, I guess so.
Because they're looking at this fantasy girl, and she's doing mm-hmm. all this in front of him, and he still isn't noticing her. Mm. She's saying football stats on top of that, and he still isn't noticing her. You know?
That is so weird that she's like that. But is there no point in the movie where she tells him to please shut up about football? Because in the book, constantly, she's telling him, don't talk about football. I don't want to hear about football.
And then she starts spewing football stats.
Oh, really? She never does start spewing the stats. And she never turns. She never shows that she's been hiding that in the book. Unless I just skipped over that part, because I did kind of glide over lots of pages because I couldn't wait for it to be over. Really, every time it got too much into football, I just kept thinking, wouldn't this book be a lot better if he lived in a family of people who like obsessed about the Oscars instead of football? If they were all just Oscar fanatics instead of Eagles fanatics,
I would
like it a lot better. I would understand it.
Same here, but you know, even football fan like Chris Tapley's a football fan. He didn't really like it too much. You know, he thought it was a mess. He agrees with us about it, but. Let's just talk quickly about how things can change and shift in the race. And that now we're talking about things that can, for instance, I remember in 2010, my favorite year, when Social Network and versus the King's Speech, everybody was saying King's Speech was going to win. And heading into the Oscar race, we all thought the King's, I want to correct history to say, before the National Board of Review announced, we all thought it was King's Speech to lose. But... Mm-hmm. The National Board of Review announced 4 awards for The Social Network, mm-hmm. which is really rare. I think in all
And then all of the critics fell in line behind it. All the critics, we had never seen before.
No, and that's why people started to think it was going to win. They knew it was too cold and it wasn't Oscar-y. Mm-hmm. But the only movies that have ever won that many National Board of Reviews, I'm pretty sure, have gone on to win Best Picture. It's unprecedented for that to happen and for it not to win. So... this year, what we think the National Board of Review is going to do. Let's say it picks The Master. That's going to greatly alter the race. The Master's suddenly going to have Oscar buzz. If Silver Linings wins the National Board of Review, or the LA Film Critics, which it could win either, or the New York Film Critics, which it could win either, I think Silver Linings has to take the number one spot if it wins any of those awards, because it's suddenly got stronger validity than it just won the Audience Award in Toronto.
Yeah, it's suddenly legitimized.
Yeah. So,
do you think that's possible?
Let's look back.
Am I looking at it irrationally because I wasn't that crazy about the movie that I can't even imagine a critics group that takes it all seriously would ever pick it as the best movie of this year?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the National Board of Review. It's a group that a lot of people like to criticize. They're dismissed by people like David Pollan. They're dismissed by... you know, a lot of people who think that they're either whores or that they're bought off or that they're not real reporters. And
Well, who are they? Do we know anything about the membership?
We don't really know.
I have the impression that there's some academics and some film scholars, some maybe some film professors among them. And so they have a little bit of that cachet and that prestige, but I'm not even sure if that's correct or not. I just have that impression about them.
That's the impression that they try to give, but the fact that they won't tell you who are the members makes them instantly suspect.
Right, but it doesn't matter in the awards race because whether it's there are a couple of awards groups that are unassailable, and one is the National Board of Review and the other is the Golden Globes. It doesn't matter how many times people criticize them. They still are what they are, and what they are is an early influencer of the awards, period. I've been doing this long enough to notice that they do impact. I've compared and contrasted the National Board of Review with Best Picture. I could read them to you right now if you'd like, and I'll tell you what I think has the best chance right now of getting this spot, and I think it's going to be Life of Pi, is my prediction.
Oh, is that right? I'm surprised to hear that, but I'm happy to hear it, but I'm surprised.
Well, they awarded Sense and Sensibility. I think it could easily go to that. It went to Pulp Fiction, so it could be Django Unchained, but that seems a little rough for them. So reading backwards, we go Hugo, The Social Network, Up in the Air, Slumdog Millionaire, No Country for Old Men, Letters from Iwo Jima, Good Night and Good Luck, Finding Neverland, Mystic River, The Hours, Moulin Rouge, Quills, American Beauty, Gods and Monsters, L.A. Confidential, Shine, Sense and Sensibility, Pulp Fiction, Schindler's List, Howard's End, The Silence of the Lambs, Dances with Wolves, Driving Miss Daisy, Empire of the Sun, A Room with a View, The Color Purple, Passage to India, Betrayal. So they obviously love Spielberg. So Lincoln.
What do those movies, if they have something in common, how can we characterize those movies? I would say that they all have a certain social consciousness, that they all have a certain, it's like a social commentary type of movie.
Well, Finding Neverland stands out for some reason because that doesn't seem to fit in any way. What it strikes me as is a lot of them were movies that the critics loved that didn't win Best Picture, like The Social Network, like Mystic River, like Hugo.
They're brainier movies than the Oscars. They're a little bit brainier and more intellectual, and they have a little more literary pedigree in general. A lot of them are novel adaptations that are from some pretty prestigious novels.
It's easy to make fun of them, but when you look at their output, they've made some decent choices. They didn't always necessarily pick my pick for those different years, but I can't see any movie on there that I wouldn't necessarily want to see again.
Right. They tend to pick movies that are weepies. They like serious dramas. They're also a little bit more daring than I think the only movie in recent history that they nominated or that they picked for their prize was Quills, which didn't get nominated for Best Picture. Everything else from Quills onward did. Their track record for wins, they usually, the film that they pick usually wins every critic award and then goes on to win the Oscar, except for Social Network. They picked All the President's Men and not Rocky. They picked The Turning Point, Days of Heaven, Manhattan, Ordinary People, which matched with the Oscars, Chariots of Fire, which matched with the Oscars, Gandhi, Betrayal, A Passage to India. And they go all the way back to 1932.
I'm seeing 1929, actually. That was actually the first one I'm looking at. That's one of the reasons why they have so much prestige, I think, is because they are almost as old as the Oscars.
And they pick good movies like that the Oscars didn't, like Grapes of Wrath and Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
So. And Sunset Boulevard.
What's interesting about them to me is because they're first, their awards aren't influenced by everything that's come before it. I mean, it seems to me there's always a certain point in the season where it feels like people are just sort of ratifying what has already happened, and it just kind of becomes inevitable. These guys are just they're just making their pick sort of out of the blue. There's sort of an implied integrity to that.
Absolutely.
There is an integrity, and I would say that also, since we did mention, I don't know if it was on record or not, but since we might have mentioned that they have been criticized for being a little bit attached to a certain studio, maybe Warner Brothers, that the Warner Brothers films don't ever win the number one spot, but they may be included in the top 10, but they're not so hoary about it that they anoint it number one.
Right. I wasn't looking at the top teners either.
Yeah, the top 10. There is almost always a Warner Brothers film in the top 10. And sometimes you wonder how it got in there, like right. Hereafter, maybe.
Right. Or this year it might be that Clint Eastwood movie,
Behind the Curve. Or Trouble with the Curve, yeah. Behind the Curve.
That describes it.
I think that the movies, I don't think Silver Linings will win. Just looking at their history, it's possible, but it doesn't seem like that movie to me.
Doesn't seem to be any other movie on their list of things that have already won that matches up with that movie.
Right, not there. It doesn't seem to be their taste, but there could be wrong. But I would say it would probably be either Lincoln, or Life of Pi,
or Argo.
Or Argo, yeah. I could see them going with either any of those. I could also see them going totally weird and bold, like Beast of the Southern Wild. Or we don't know about Les Mis or Zero Dark Thirty, so we just have to put
Django.
Or Django. Have to put those aside for the moment because they're going to be voting soon. It's like an early award comes out. I'm sure they'll all see that movie first. So sometimes their pick comes out before anybody else has even seen the movie, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, I haven't seen Pi, I haven't seen Django, I haven't seen Les Mis yet, or Zero Dark Thirty. Those will hopefully be coming soon. But based on what I've seen, I'm just going to go out on a limb and I'm going to predict Lincoln right now.
Okay. You predict Lincoln. I'm going
to
predict
Life. I reserve the right to change my mind.
I'm predicting Life of Pi just for the hell of it.
I'll say Lincoln, too, just because I have the impression that it's not backed up by the list that you read at all, but I just have the impression that they go for historical, socially significant films that have a little substance to them that are not always so ethereal.
Right, right. That's true. That's a good point. Yeah. They did pick Moulin Rouge, though.
Yeah, that's true. And they do have, in their top 10, they have some really daring choices, like they chose Drive last year in their top 10.
Yeah. And they picked Up in the Air for 2009, which is a strange choice for that year.
Mm-hmm.
At that point in the race, though, it seemed like that was everybody's favorite movie. I felt for that. I liked the movie better than both of you, but even besides that, it just seemed it had that air of inevitability about it at that point.
So people will say about them that they're really swayed by, say, Scott Rudin, and that they're really swayed by stars like George Clooney.
Or Eastwood.
But I feel like they're swayed by passion and all their movies right now, going back to No Country, really. I can't speak for Letters from Iwo Jima, because that was a weird year. But No Country, Slumdog, Up in the Air, Social Network, Hugo, those were all movies that were being passionately advocated by bloggers, you know, but like me, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like whatever they pick, it's going to be a movie that people are passionately blogging for. I don't think it's going to be Silver Linings, but I would be really shocked to see if it is. New York and L.A. are slightly different from National Board of Review because they actually are critics who review movies. And they tend to be bolder, I would say. The New York Film Critics actually has a better track record of predicting Best Picture than the L.A. Film Critics. But what do you guys think that the New York Film Critics are going to pick? That's a tough one, isn't it? They really liked Silver Linings. They could go for that.
I would have to go and look and see what the different reviewers have said about each film, but I kind of feel like New York is going to go for something heady, and that makes me think The Master, but I can't remember how all the different critics fell on that one.
Uh-huh. All right, so let's read back. We go, these are all the films that have won New York. The Artist, Social Network, of course, because it won everything. The Hurt Locker, Milk, No Country for Old Men, United 93, Brokeback Mountain, Sideways, Return of the King, Far From Heaven. This is their good phase back here now. This isn't their Oscar suck-up phase now. Far From Heaven, Mulholland Drive, Traffic, Topsy Turvy, Saving Private Ryan, L.A. Confidential, Fargo, Leaving Las Vegas, Quiz Show, Schindler's List, The Player, Silence of the Lambs, which won everything. Goodfellas, My Left Foot, The Accidental Tourist, Broadcast News, Hannah and Her Sisters, Pritzi's Honor, A Passage to India. I think that they go for... For some reason, I don't feel like they're going to go for Lincoln. I would be shocked if they did. I just feel like it's too safe of a choice for them. It's not bold enough, so they're going to want to pick something that stands out more, something that's a critic's darling. They might go for The Master.
See, I'm going to say Argo, maybe. I'm going to say, I think both critics, L.A. and New York, could go for Argo because they're smart and sharp and really technically proficient and more proficient. I mean, you know, they're masterly, and they're also brainy. You know, it's a smart movie. Argo's a smart movie.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. We have.
Talking about perceptions, isn't it weird that we all have the perception that the Master has mixed reviews, and it actually has a really high, it's the highest score, tied for the highest score in Metacritic.
Yeah, so it's Beasts of the Southern Wild, The Master, Argo, Lincoln, and Amor all have the same score. Mm. Isn't that funny? And there's nothing higher than that that's in wide release. Those are the highest you get on Metacritic, which is really weird because Hurt Locker got like 94, and same with Social Network. They were way up in the 90s on there.
Mm-hmm.
What's your predictions for New York film critics? Let's just all lay it down.
I'm going to stick with Argo.
Yeah.
Even though it does lack the edgy quality, I like Argo.
Yeah, I like Argo too. And if New York doesn't pick it, then I think LA will.
Okay, I'm going to take Lincoln for New York. I think he's going to win director and picture at New York Film Critics. I also think it's going to win. No, I think Argo will win Los Angeles. Now let's do LA Film Critics really fast.
LA is hard for me to predict. I mean, they're all hard for me to predict because I don't know what I'm talking about. But it seems like a lot of times with LA, since it comes out after New York, there's sometimes maybe I'm reading into their motives, but it often feels like they try to present themselves as an alternative to the New York critics. They often match up, but a lot of times they seem to just go in a different direction just because.
Yeah, they don't want to be like Me Too. They it's not as if they're trying to be an alternative so much as they just don't want to be a copycat.
Right. I'm probably reading too much into it. I'm going back to the 80s when they went out on a limb and went for Brazil when nobody was loving that movie.
Well, they picked The Descendants last year, which was the big get out of Telluride, which is the same with Argo. So it's really possible that they will pick Argo. And the other thing to realize about this year is that the National Board of Review is coming out actually after the New York Film Critics announces first, and they're really early.
Really?
So whatever they pick, it's probably going to be an early entry-ish. It's not going to probably be late, one of the later ones. I think if Django Unchained is really good, the LA Film Critics could pick it. Remember when they picked a movie that wasn't even out yet? Does anybody remember what that was? I don't remember, but they had seen it, and they picked it for their number one before anybody had ever even seen it. It was There Will Be Blood. Remember, no one had seen it, and it won.
Yeah, I'm going to go New York Film Critics, Argo, LA Film Critics, The Master.
Okay, I'm going New York Film Critics. I'm going Life of Pi for the National Board of Review, Lincoln for the New York, and then I'm going to say they're going to pull a wild card on us and give Django Unchained for LA.
Okay.
What about you, Ryan?
I'm going to say, I guess, Lincoln for the National Board of Review, Argo for the New York Film Critics, and The Master for LA Film Critics.
So you and I are the same.
Was that the same? Sorry, I stole yours.
No. That's not why
Maybe
I said
that's
that.
Where I heard it.
In your predictions so that I have them so that we can remember them, because I don't know how we're going to remember them otherwise. And readers are going to go, you said that you predicted that.
I won't remember 5 minutes from now what I said, so unless I write it down, I'll have a different opinion in 10 minutes.
We should also remember that we reserve the right to change our minds as we get closer to the award announcement. These are just some early possible predictions. So.
Yeah, there's still too many movies for me to see to really even feel like I know what I'm talking about. I mean, I still am not going to feel like I know what I'm talking about, but
this is closer. Okay, well, that was fun, you guys. That was really fun.
It always is.
I've had a lot of fun the last couple of times. Always do, but the last two episodes have been really fun.
And they have been. You've been listening to episode 8 of Oscar Podcast with Craig Kennedy from livinginCinema.com, Sasha Stone, and Ryan Adams from awardsdaily.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Oscar Podcast. And the bumper music today was Blackhearted Love by PJ Harvey and John Parrish, and All I Need by Radiohead. Thanks for listening.